Steve-O.
Welcome back to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk of the LOB, 1310 a.m. on this day, March 1st. How are we doing, Deb?
I'm good. How are you?
Never been happier.
Great.
We have a very interesting show this week that we just pre-recorded. In the next few minutes, I think we'll get right to it. We have Orlando DeLoge. He is an emeritus professor of law at USM and somebody who has some really interesting policy experience. And then in the second hour at 12:06, we have Meg Weston, who's president of Maine Media Workshops in college, and she talks about all things digital and creative and visual arts in Maine.
Fantastic.
So why don't we go right into the interview with Orlando. Thank you for listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. I fought the law and the law won. We may get some clarification on how that whole thing happened with our guest, Orlando DeLoge. It's great to have you here, sir. You are a self-described policy wonk, columnist for The Forecaster, but also emeritus professor of law at USM, teaching for over 40 years. Before we get into your tenure at University of Southern Maine, which for more than 40 years taught full-time, if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about how you ended up coming to Maine. I'm always fascinated about people who really contribute to our fabric here. Some people were born here, but many more people found their way here for different reasons. And how did you come to Maine?
Well, I was born in New York, lived there for 12 years, and my family then moved to the Mountain States and subsequently on to the West Coast. I did high school and undergraduate work at the University of Utah in Salt Lake, and was in the military for a couple of years. And from the military, gravitated to a graduate school and law school in Wisconsin, and then had to look for real work. And there were several opportunities, and the most interesting one was at a new startup law school at the University of Maine School of Law within the city of Portland. And I took that, and I've stayed here ever since.
In my notes, it shows that you started in 1966 and taught full-time for about 40 years, retiring in the mid-2000s, 2006.
Yep.
So you really saw from the very start of the program to the continued of the growth and USM really becoming kind of a first-class, world-recognized institution.
Well, I think that's correct. I've served under at the law school under every dean the school has had. I came actually 2 years after a startup a group of both permanent faculty and visitors got the ball rolling. That happened in 1964 when they took over a small private institution, the old Portland Law School, that was unaccredited and really did turn out some wonderful people, but it was very small and it was catch as catch can. And then we became a more permanent institution, accredited fully by the ABA and the ALS, and have achieved some distinction, at least regionally, and some of our people are all over the country and all over the world, in fact.
Absolutely. I'm always interested in law, not just because of the show Law and Order, which I find fascinating, but it is both from the founding of our country and the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, from the framework of how we are organized as a society, law plays a critical role.
It does.
And for people that go into law and in different areas, but in your case, it appears that after you becoming an attorney and getting your JD, you decided to focus much of your legal attention to the academic side of law and teaching, as opposed to what some people would look at as practicing in either criminal or civil. Talk a little bit about that, I guess, fork in the road for you And I personally have the greatest respect for anyone teaching any subject because I think it's really the core to our growth as a society. But what was the decision-making for you in the early 60s when you were maybe more drawn to the academic side of it than the courtroom side of it?
Yeah, that is interesting. I actually, coming out of the military, thought I was going to do graduate work in economics, and I went to the University of Wisconsin with a teaching assistantship and the idea that I'd get a PhD in economics. At that point in time, the new toy in the technological world was the computer. It was twice the size of this room, but it was better than anything we had up to that point, which included the abacus and the and slide rules and other advances. But everyone was into econometrics and modeling, and I wasn't. I was in the economics jargon. I was an old institutionalist. I was watching the reality that we were burning down cities at the time, and there was a great deal of restiveness in urban core areas, and I wondered how that could be addressed. So the people that seemed to be talking about some of those issues more were people that were operating out of the law school. I was working for the state of Wisconsin at the time, and I finished up a master's degree in economics. I wanted to have something to show for a year and a half of work there, and then I shifted over to the law school, and without ever really intending to practice law, but feeling that a lot of the people I was dealing with within the framework of Wisconsin state government at the time were reshaping urban and state-level institutions to try and deal with a range of housing and model cities and related programs that were on people's drawing boards. And I thought that was interesting stuff. It interested me. And when I finished law school, the idea of practicing held little appeal to me. Most of the jobs that I was offered were in either teaching or governmental agencies, and I opted for teaching, and I came to a new law school to do it.
We have Orlando DeLuc here in the studio. He is Emeritus Professor of Law of USM, also writes a column for The Forecaster under the title Policy Wonk. By the way, was that self-described, or did an editor designate you as the Policy Wonk?
No, Mo Melchak, who's been the head of the editorial pages and a lot of the writing at The Forecaster, thought that was a shorter description than any I offered him, and I said I can live with that. I was more interested in having an outlet, Maine Ahead, I'd been writing for a couple of years. I was a business mag out of Bangor, and right. I've written for a half a dozen other outlets at one time or another. I still steer some stuff into the Maine Lawyers Review, which is a biweekly tabloid type of outlet. Mo's choice. I'm saddled with it. I don't mind it. It does describe a lot of what I do within the framework of my work at the School of Law. I've always thought one should begin to take some of the classroom ideas and deal with them in the real world, and you ought to be able to talk to the leadership of legislatures and governor's offices and city councils and offer them alternatives to where they seem to be going.
Also noted, you're one of the founding members of the Maine Civil Liberties Union, and it looks like their formation started in the mid-60s, 67, I believe. Talk a little bit for people. You know, everyone's familiar with, I think, the term ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, and it pops up at various times relative to very social, legal, legislative issues where people say, well, the ACLU supports that or is against that. And obviously the Maine Civil Liberties Union is our state organization. But talk a little bit about, for people that may not be familiar with either the history or the organizational structure of the ACLU, and then also the Maine Civil Liberties Union, how it's set up, what it means, and in your opinion, why you feel it's really an important function or check and balance for social issues here in Maine and across the country?
I think before there was an NAACP, before there was a CORE, before there was an Urban League, before there were environmental organizations, natural resources, defense councils, and so forth, the ACLU came on the scene in the 20s, 1920s, 30s, right in that era, to defend civil rights, civil liberties, First Amendment, free speech issues when they were under attack, and they seem like they're always under attack. In almost every generation, there's a Joe McCarthy type of
every major assault. Shift. Whether going back before ACLU, going back to 1860s in segregation and slavery, there's opposition. You look at
the Muckrakers,
the women's rights movements in terms of voting. Then you look at segregation. And at every point when there's been a big social shift, and most recently marriage rights, equality rights, there's a shift. And then when you look back for most of these issues, it's clear that what was the right path, but it feels like there's always resistance.
Well, I think that's true, and the other thing that's also true is that these battles are never won. They are reshaped, reconfigured. You win them over and over again. We're still banning books in some jurisdictions, in some parts of the countries. Certain books that offend either people who are opposed to abortion, opposed to gay rights, opposed to a full-blown civil rights for minorities, and so you're having to reestablish or reassert or redefine, re-protect, if you will, those legitimate and constitutionally protected rights, the root stock of everything ACLU does and then the Maine Civil Liberties Union has done is rooted in constitutionally protected rights, privacy, religious freedom, free speech, equal protection, due process.
And I think there's a political role for ACLU and also the Maine Civil Liberties Union. But within those organizations, what is the compass? Because some of these issues aren't as clear as black and white. Some of them are subjective.
Oh, and some of them have divided the organization.
But there's typically a message that comes out of the ACLU or the Maine Civil where there's a very forceful kind of righteous positioning where this is happening to this group or this policy is shifting that it doesn't serve this or there's not open transparency in this area. But in order to assert those things with some degree of either certainty or some voice, how do the organizations inside know? Because as you know from law, truth and facts are different things, and it depends on which lens you're looking at. And how do these organizations who play such a vital role in our society in terms of speaking out many times for people that are disadvantaged, that don't have the platform to speak out for themselves, how do they know when they're speaking out on an issue if this is really what we should be doing, and what's the mechanism internally to calibrate that?
Well, you're never quite sure that there's a hard black and white. The line is crisp and right down right there. What you're always balancing, often, I'll say often balancing and not always, is competing interests. The interests. Look at some of the battles in Portland recently between homeless people who want to approach others for $1, $2, $3.
And you're talking about the ordinance that they've considered in terms of in all through Portland, but on Franklin, Ontario, there are people out there with signs saying, "I'm homeless. I need money."
The city looked at it from a standpoint of safety, traffic safety, traffic interdiction, and put an ordinance in place. The Maine Civil Liberties Union took the position it goes farther than it needs to go. These people are...
Was the issue freedom of speech?
Freedom of speech, yeah. Right to petition, right to ask, right to be on a public space. The same issue is being fought out by a little different group, the pro-choice and the anti-abortion people on a piece of sidewalk in downtown Portland that Planned Parenthood facilities are behind that door, and they provide a wide range of low-income public health services, stuff that's not being done.
And in that case, I think the argument was that while one group may have the right to protest or speak out against, yeah. one group has the right to have...
Not to be intimidated.
Not to be intimidated.
Yeah.
And whether that demarcation line is 40 feet, 50 feet, 70 feet, I think that becomes subjective. But how does the Maine Civil Liberties Union know in that case where it's there's a lot of variance between what the two positions may be?
Well, you look at the ordinance that emerges and you ask, is it overbroad? We understand where they're coming from. We understand the balance the city is trying to strike, but have they struck the balance with too heavy a thumb on the scale for one side or the other? This very case was recently argued again in the Supreme Court of the United States. There are some cases that came out of Western states, cases in the wake of some violence in which the separation seemed to many more than necessary, overly protective. But then we get overly protective when there's been a violent episode. And the Supreme Court in the recent case heard not 3 months ago, be decided by this June, may very well narrow back some of those earlier holdings, and Portland may find that it's going to have to narrow back its ordinance because it borrowed from some of the thinking and positioned the anti-abortion people quite far removed from the entrance point to the Planned Parenthood facility. So you're striking balances within a social context and within a specific setting, and lines get drawn and redrawn. But I think the underlying thesis of the Maine Civil Liberties Union, the American Civil Liberties Union, is that these rights are under constant threat and attack. There are people that would muzzle you because they don't like what you're saying. And yet you are able to be on air and you are able to take iconoclast positions because a First Amendment right, yours, mine, the same First Amendment right that keeps a Rush Limbaugh on the air and lets him say what he would, even as offensive as it may be to some, protects the larger right without saying that, Steve Woods, your message is a little too sharp, a little too edgy, a little too against the grain of the social order here. We're gonna shut you down.
Yeah, I don't think I wade into territory like Rush Limbaugh, where you said he may be offensive. I think many times he's clearly offensive, and I think that many things he says I personally think are just repugnant. But I agree with you that his right to say them, while I may disagree with what he says, it's the right itself that is to the benefit to all of us.
And if we can shut Rush Limbaugh down, right. It's just a step and a different philosophical leadership that leads to shutting you down.
Well, I bring up controversial things like, you know, at the Yarmouth Clam Festival, should we swap out cotton candy with candy apples? And so I tackle the hard issues. I'm not there's not much controversy you'll find at Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOD, 1310 a.m. Let's shift gears just a little bit. We have Orlando Derlogue here. He is a policy wonk columnist for The Forecaster. It's a column that goes every week, and there's always some interesting point of view there that I've been following for a long time. He's also an emeritus professor of law at USM. I want to talk about the intersection of law and politics and policy. In addition to your background, which I just mentioned, you've been very involved with government over decades, serving 5 years in the Department of Environmental Protection Agency, it looks like, an elected member of the Portland City Council, 5 years on the Portland Planning Board, and also served in a number of legislative and gubernatorial task forces. So in addition to your experience in academia teaching law and policy, in addition to writing, you've operated here in this state at some of the highest levels. You've seen the mechanics of government on a municipal level, on a county level, and a state level. So I think you have a really interesting perspective. Now in 2014, where there's an election coming up, and it feels just to me like there's a level of contentiousness and there's a level of dysfunction that has gone from the federal government, and now maybe it's because of economic pressures that go downstream. It's really impacting Maine and our policymaking and who we're electing. And first off, do you feel a different climate in 2014, or is this just a natural cycle that you've seen over decades of being involved with policy in Maine?
No, I think it's a little different. I think, unfortunately, in my view, at both the national level and at the level of state government in many states, not all states, but in many states, there's an acrimony. There's a sharper edge division between the philosophical roots of what we might call progressive or just democratic voices on one hand, and Republican, and within Republican you have I guess the right edge of Republican philosophy embodied in the Tea Party right now, and I just called it a sharper edged dialogue between these participants in the political process than there used to be.
I call it tribal versus communal. And I think that in history we've had more communal, whether it's in the federal government where Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan get together and different parties could Angus King has a famous quote, and I'm paraphrasing, "It's hard to be adversarial and ugly to your opponent if you know the names of their children." Meaning that if you have some emotional connection, it's hard to say this person's an idiot and a jerk if you have some direct personal. And we've lost that. It feels like that's really affecting government and how policy is set.
Well, I think it's unfortunately true, and I don't know how or when we'll get over it. I read a lot of history of American politics and our experiment in democratic institutions. There have been other periods where the elbows were high and the rhetoric was sharp. And you thought, how will we get over this acrimonious division? So it's not totally unique, but it's certainly it has taken some periods of time and sometimes with difficulty, and it's taken some unique leaders to help us pull out of this. A Lincoln in his era, a Teddy Roosevelt in his era, a Wilson, a Roosevelt. One had high hopes that for Mr. Obama, but I think he falls victim to both being a hopeful voice on one hand, but in a period of economic downturn that was sharp and needed to be dealt with, and rising acrimony on the other. I think most people would say he hasn't been as successful in bridging these gaps as he had hoped he would be, and as and in state, I see much the same thing. We've had periods with Republican governors. Jock McKernan comes to mind, who was able to work with Democratic voices in the legislature relatively comfortably, independent voices. Angus, certainly our present senator, went through a period where as an independent, he found that he could bring in to the discussion and figure out a solution to most of the problems facing the state then, utilizing both Republican and Democratic voices. Today, we Mr. Baldacci left office with some loose ends, the hospital debt being one, the economic downturn being another. How he might have handled it differently had he been at the start of his administration rather than the end, we'll never really know. But there was a sense of time for a change, a close election. And the idiosyncrasies of Maine's electoral processes. Three strong candidates, two of which proved to be not quite as strong as they thought they were, and so a minority governor is elected, 38% of the vote. And he's governed with a fidelity to the philosophic points of view that he brought to the table, but
that's a great term, a fidelity. That's my issue with the current administrator. Well, there's many, but you just talked about kind of the election process. You know, it's well known that Governor LePage was elected with 39% of the vote, the popular vote, the vote. We don't have an electoral system in terms of Maine politics. I've gotten into this discussion with my good friend Ray Richardson many times, and I've advanced this, my line of thinking, to my friends who are conservative. I believe that for anyone running for governor, and whether it's Mike Michoud, whether it's Paul LePage running for re-election, that when you run for office, you identify and you communicate your policies, your positions, and it's going to it will satiate some members of the public. It won't make some people happy, but the moment you take the oath of office, I believe whoever's our governor, and I believe the same thing on the presidential level, once you take the oath of office, you need to shift not your principles, not what you believe in, but your fidelity, as you just mentioned. And the fidelity in the case of Paul LePage would have been to be consistent with his principles, but instead of saying, I am now the governor of my 39% people who support me, I will reinforce positions that they like. I will continue to cater, listen to, and have more access to that subset universe. I would have preferred if our Governor LePage said, I won the election, I took the oath of office, and now my duty is to 1.3 million Mainers. And you may not agree with some of my policy, and I'm not going to shift some of the things I believe in, but my obligation, my moral, fiduciary, constitutional obligation is to every Mainer. And it does. I personally feel that hasn't happened. And I would like to see hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think your analysis, though, Steve, with all due respect, fails to take into account that he truly believes he's doing exactly what you would call upon him to do. He truly believes that by cutting taxes, we will grow the economy. He truly believes that a smaller government it will produce within the society a greater retention of tax dollars in the hands of individuals who will spend it prudently, who will advance their own interests and become entrepreneurs, and that will grow the society. He truly believes the idea that we have too large a subset of the society that are welfare dependent, and if we shrink that welfare benefit package, that these people will be driven to work harder, to strive harder, to find work. Ted Cruz and Rand Paul at the national level don't think they're representing 20 or 25 or 30%. They think they are taking positions that will truly benefit all of the country. I think the evidence to me is that they're wrong. I look at cutting taxes and go back 40, 50, 60 years, and I say there are periods in that time frame in which the taxes have been significantly higher than they are today at the federal level, and we thrived. The economy was growing. Unemployment was low. We were moving forward. There was a higher degree of egalitarian distribution of the entrepreneurial genius of the American public in a free economy. And I simply say, look, let's get some facts behind the philosophic predilections.
But what happens when facts just seem irrelevant? Well, you know, something as you would think as very simplistic as President Obama was born in Hawaii. There's a live birth certificate. He wasn't born in Kenya. Yeah. There were doctors there. There was a newspaper report. It wasn't a conspiracy. But if 30 or 40% of one political party still believes that he was born in Kenya, that's not subjective. I mean, anyone can be subjective. I can tell you that right now I'm 10 feet tall, or I can tell you that anything crazy, and you can say, well, that's your opinion. And when things like that, climate change is an example. I happen to be a fan of science, love science. Didn't do well in school, but I recognize it. I recognize gravity. I recognize physical properties. And you mean there are 72 members of a climate change department, multidiscipline, geologists, marine biologists, all 72, and they're not politically motivated. There's no political overlay or filter. They're these nerdy scientists, and I say that with affection. They look at isotopes. They look at Antarctic. They look at acidity in the ocean. They couldn't care less about politics. They all believe climate change is real, but yet we're in a political fight where one side says, no, climate change is this natural cycle. It is not that threatening, whereas many people are saying it's the greatest threat to our civilization, not politics, but humans will die.
You're talking to the washed, Steve. I hear you. And I'll simply go back a long time in history to suggest to you that it took over 100 years for there to be a large consensus that the world was not flat. I mean, the evidence was mounting. The scientists, the Galileos, the Da Vincis, it was almost clear beyond belief, but it took more than 100 years before there was a general acceptance. Look at acid rain was an issue in the start of my law career, in which gravitated from urban problems to larger environmental problems, and we debated whether acid rain was really real. It took us over a generation, 20, 30 years before there was a general consensus that acid rain wasn't just some fiction of a small scientific group that was measuring what was stunting the growth of forests across northern Europe, across Canada, across the United States, but it was a phenomena that grew out of our industrialization and our use of certain fuels, and that this precipitated out in natural hydrologic processes, and as it did so over periods of time. But you see my point. It took 40 years.
I agree with the point, and maybe I'm just a little more cynical.
Impatient.
No, but with the whole world is flat thing, it was also a different time where there were limits to technology, limits to transportation, there's other stuff. So in the year 2014, it's in many ways a different reality. But my point is not that people aren't embracing it, but there are such clear numbers. We're on one side of the political spectrum.
You'd think
70 or 80% of people look at it, and they're not driven by either bias or benefit. And on the other side of the political spectrum, 70 or 80% are saying, "No, this doesn't exist." So there's variables beyond just acceptance of science. There's political messaging, and there's tribalism in terms of what we believe and how we believe.
I did a piece for Maine Ahead that was titled, The World is Not Flat, Two and Two Is Not Five, where I took up some of these very points you're making and simply said, in areas where we are akin to that sort of factual absurdity, we need to come to grips with what the evidence of your 72 science wonks with respect to global warming are telling us. I use the example of tax cuts giving rise to economic growth by a trickle-down theory. Doesn't work. Hasn't worked. There's 60 years of evidence. We need to get over it. The idea that austerity budgets will stimulate the economy and that debt and deficits are the bogeyman that's holding us back. There's no evidence of that. Half of Europe went down the road of austerity budgeting. Mr. Obama's been hung out to dry by the people that want not to grow the economy but want to curtail deficits. And all it's done is prolong the economic downturn in these European countries. Instead of getting better with austerity budgeting, they got worse because we weren't creating jobs there. We weren't the people who were in the middle or beneath the middle in their annual incomes had no income to spend to stimulate the economy. Austerity budgets don't work.
No argue. I agree. It's all Greece's fault. The euro, I look at the European Union. Let's bring the attention back to Maine a little bit.
Sure.
And by the way, we have Orlando DeLogue here. He is a columnist for The Forecaster, also an emeritus professor of law at USM. He's taught for 40 years. Served in the DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, also a member of the Portland City Council, 5 years on the planning board. I think he's held every office and position in Maine. He's touched all the bases. You wrote a column, I believe, on February 17th, talking about revenue sharing in Maine needs a permanent fix. And I would like to propose my point of view on that relative to your column and then talk about it a little bit. We have just over 35,000 square miles here in Maine. We have about 488 municipalities, and we have about 1.3 million people. And so relative to analysis, which involves numbers and math and an Excel spreadsheet versus a Microsoft Word document, I believe that we have certain structural hurdles in Maine, by the way we're spread out, the way our infrastructure is spread out. We have a state that is designed with an infrastructure support system that could accommodate 8 million people. We have 1.3. We're entering a period where new economy dictates that time, speed, and efficiency favors municipalities in terms of capital investment and for companies coming in. Things are moving faster. We need to, in order to have better educational outcomes and health care, we need more density of people because the more we spread people out, every mile, literally and figuratively, we add inefficiency. So my view on Maine is that 200 years ago, we settled in a pattern that didn't foresee trains, planes, automobiles, fiber optics. Nobody's fault. I'm not blaming Governor LePage. I'm not blaming Governor Baldacci. Nobody's fault. There were land grants after the war. Government gave out land grants. That's why so much of the coastline has these beautiful estates as opposed to commercial properties and restaurants. Nobody's fault. But in the year 2014 and going forward, the economy doesn't care about our history. Capital investment goes, much like water and energy, where there's least resistance. So people will invest in foreign countries for development. People will invest in Iowa, whatever. But here in Maine, we are structurally not set up as efficiently as we can be for the new economy. And because we're so spread out and there's so much cost that we keep introducing these economic barriers that create tax burdens, which create barriers for outside capital coming in. And instead of addressing that relative to revenue sharing, we talk about liquor sales tax being increased or gaming revenue or casino revenue going from education funds to general funds. Nobody's really talking about what I think is the fundamental issue, is the inefficiency of our infrastructure. And we need to be better at it, and that goes right to the core of revenue sharing.
But you can't get those 488 towns to agree in the same way that we couldn't get some 280 school districts to realign themselves in a pattern of school administrative districts or in a more efficient pattern of municipalities that would allow most of those municipalities to have a reasonable tax base that they could utilize to bear the costs of municipal government. I mean, look at what's happening with respect to school administrative districts. Mr. Baldacci made a gallant effort at consolidating that 280 odd to a more manageable number where there would be economies of scale, where there would be reasonable classroom sizes.
But that's where I differ with my good friend John Baldacci, because that was an administrative consolidation. My argument is physics. We have physically too much infrastructure in the physical infrastructure, asphalt, cement, water treatment, storm water. We are facing $5 billion in the next 5 years of infrastructure cost because major infrastructure, roadways, support systems go in 30, 40-year building cycles, right? And so the state doesn't budget capital reserve. Some municipalities do. I'm chairman of the Yarmouth Town Council. Mm-hmm. We have capital reserves, so we know we're going to need a new fire engine in 6 years. We know a roof will have to go on a school in 7 years, so we anticipate. The state doesn't do their budgeting like that. No. And so what will happen is for the next 5 or 10 years, if we don't change the way the state is literally laid out, then I believe that these barriers will continue to grow. And instead of addressing the real issues, we, you know, the issues of healthcare and education, which are primary human issues, in my mind, are critical to life, safety, liberty, and every human being.
All of the above.
But they're all subordinate to how the economics work. If we don't have an economic taxation policy that works, there's no way we can provide health care benefits or we can provide educational benefits, because at the end of the day, we work in a capital system where if the numbers don't add up, we defer and we expand problems. We take out bonds, we have debt, and then the taxes go up, and then outside companies don't come in. But nobody is really talking about the umbrella issue, which is the fundamental economics of the state. And people are saying, well, we should have A through D school grading. We should, main care expansion is good, which I support, and I support the Affordable Care Act. But the real issue, the real heavy lifting we have to do at the state is at a fundamental level, and that feels like it's too complex or there's not the political will to do it.
There isn't. I just simply would tell you that whether it is long-term capital investment, whether it is shrinking the number of school districts, whether it is conjoining the 488 municipal units of government, each of which has a history, each of which wants to continue being king of its own hill. We can't even get the 16 counties with respect to the handling of their jails to be structurally reconfigured so that we make statewide decisions as opposed to county by county decisions. We've created a board and left it without the power to effectuate the economic and fiscal reforms that would give rise to economies of scale and economies of efficiently managing the jail system, the court system, the movement of people between jails and courts, and so forth. There isn't a lot of stomach for at any level of government for long run thinking. A handful of towns. A handful of states.
And I agree, but here in Maine, I think in one way it's a positive attribute for the state that we have these deep roots, and we have kind of a cultural predisposition to saying, that's the way we've always done it, and we'll get through it. And my argument is that in the year 2014, we're in an economic environment going forward where we need greater skills. The economy's switching from resource-based or textile to other things. And so these parochial provincial attitudes
are
quaint. Well, but I look
hard
at it. But here's my view. If we had a when you look at natural disasters all over the world, when you look in Japan and there's a tsunami and there's the nuclear meltdown, you look down at Katrina in New Orleans, people look at those scenarios with an emotional, visceral response and say, wow, that's awful. The government steps in and says, hey, we're going to have help, and we have to move people over here. We have to respond this way. And with a natural disaster, it's easier to kind of incorporate into your thinking and accept. I believe we're in the middle of a financial crisis in an economic disaster, I mean. But it's harder to see, it's harder to explain, and it's harder for people to visualize. Where if there was a tsunami that wiped out five towns in Milo and Dover, Foxcroft, and some other towns, and the state said, hey, we're going to provide land and support and help people as we would as a compassionate state, people would kind of accept it. But if the state tries to cut back funding in some of these rural areas, it's almost like it's criminal. And there's an imbalance to what towns are contributing to the general fund, what towns are getting, and it's not like there's hope that some of these economies are coming back because some of these industries aren't coming back, and nobody's being honest about it.
But look how ineffectively a sophisticated Japanese economy and political system with a high degree of top-down control has handled that tsunami and the areas affected by that and the whole aftermath of Fukushima.
Right.
I mean,
I'm not suggesting we adopt their mode. I'm suggesting that people react.
They haven't been equal to the task.
Right.
They had the shocking event that you might have thought would have produced a more effective changes in the way they produced, regulated, and handled their energy needs. It hasn't happened. The cleanup hasn't happened. Radioactive materials are still pouring into the waters as a result of that. And now we're worried, are they going to reach our shores, having traversed the whole of the Pacific?
Right. But here in Maine, you know, if we have 480 municipalities, and I don't want to personalize it by naming some towns, many of them in rural Maine, because there are people there that it's their livelihoods, it's their family history. But if we have some communities that are basically insolvent, and because of a shift in the economy or the timber industry or anything, the economy isn't coming back, but these communities require greater in greater support from federal programs and state programs. Yeah. And within the state, those programs create barriers for outside capital coming in, and they come out of people's pockets in other areas of the state. My argument is we're not helping some of these rural communities. By giving X amount of money, we're in many cases locking multi-generations into this spiral that isn't better, the education suffering, the healthcare suffering. If we really wanted to be compassionate, we would say, hey, nobody has to move anywhere if you don't want to, but we're going to shift some of the state funds to a more proportional basis. And if you want to move to an area where there's a greater density of healthcare and education, job opportunities, we as a state will put our energy in moving you there as opposed to perpetuating an economic reality that'll never change, that's only bringing us all down.
What you say appeals to me, it appeals to you. You couldn't get 20% of the vote for that in the legislature. You couldn't get either Democratic support for it or Republican
Why?
Support for it, because it represents too dramatic a shift of the paradigm. If it were handled skillfully, we might prevent the proliferation of this fragmentation, but we're finding even that difficult.
Well, let's do it skillfully. Let's do it over 10 years. Let's say to somebody, it's not happening in by Tuesday, but if X number of people in a community want to be, you know, we know that 9 out of 10 new jobs come in the three main urban centers of Maine. Mm-hmm. Again, that's math. We know that 93% of capital coming into the state are coming into these dense areas. Again, math. And we know that there are some areas of the state that will be crumbling relative to infrastructure that will need enormous state resources mm-hmm. for fewer people that in many cases are locked into poverty, health, and educational systems. But until we can say that out loud, until the state legislature.
You're saying it out loud.
I know. I'm saying it out loud, but it may be just you, me, and Deb, and Deb's silent. She may not
agree with
us.
Actually, I agree with you.
Really?
Yeah. It would also give us an opportunity to shrink our legislature, which I think is a little too big for this state.
It is. That proposal has gone nowhere.
Right. Right. But if you do these two things at the same time, I think it would work well.
The idea of consolidation, creating a more focused expenditure of what in a relatively poor state will be for a long time to come, scarce tax dollars, scarce right. Capital investment budgets.
Just efficiency, yeah.
In a more efficient way is theoretically appealing and politically unacceptable.
But it's mathematically critical. So if the only two access points are political or appealing, then you're right. It's a tough argument. I think it's an imperative. I think it's our natural disaster. And because the state is so large and the burden and the infrastructure is so high, that the more time we waste talking about these small revenue issues in these small policy issues, we are missing the giant. We are missing the tsunami. And it wouldn't take a lot. It would only take 100,000 people, 200,000 people, like two football stadiums, to shift a little bit the paradigm. We would save billions. And if we did that, those denser areas would have better educational opportunities, better health care. And for companies coming in, they would have more skilled workers in denser areas. The whole thing churns the economy. We're going in the opposite way.
We are. We are. And we're not alone. Where you can point to this happening in probably 25 or 30 of the 50 states where there is still the spreading out of a population
right.
Base instead of the utilization of their core areas.
And I'm all for spreading out. I'm all for anyone wanting to live anywhere they want to live in Maine or any other state.
Just don't want to subsidize them.
Well, or if
Nor
we,
do
or,
I.
Or
right.
we are subsidizing, right. it needs to be at a reasonable ratio. And the people, their right to say we're not leaving, the federal government, the state government has to disproportionately keep us here. That not only is fundamentally unfair, but those are the burdens that I think are creating the problems we have. We've run out of time. We need to do this again. I don't know if we've solved anything here, but I think we've scratched the surface. Thank you so much for coming today.
It's been fun. It's been an interesting discussion.
Thank you. We have had Mr. Orlando DeLogue. He is the columnist for The Forecaster. Please go to www.theforecaster.net. Also an emeritus professor at law of USM. Former Department of Environmental Protection person, elected member of the Portland City Council. He has done everything. Great having him here. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after the top of the hour at 12:06. Thank you for listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM.